The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday, so that means it's the main course. We're broadcasting live out of Roberta's with Joe Galarraga at the engineering booth. Joe, are you there?
I'm here. How's it going?
Have you gone to sleep yet? My intros are never that exciting. But it's an exciting day. We're sponsored by Rolling Press, first of all, which is a really awesome press, printing press. It's one of the first all-green printing presses maybe in the country, and it's run by this really cool guy. And, they do all our printing at Heritage Foods, and now they're doing all of it for the radio network and doing exchanges. So we love that they're a sponsor. It's the Oscars tonight. So I don't know. I mean, I didn't see many of these movies at all, but Lincoln was really, really cool. And Daniel Day-Lewis, like, what a guy. He plays all these great Americans. He's an English guy, but, you know, Last of the Mohicans. He plays the butcher in the Five Point movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. Now here he is playing Abraham Lincoln, you know, these huge, huge roles. And, you know, his co-star in that, Tommy Lee Jones, played the pro... he was pro abolishment. Of slavery. He played that guy, that senator, and he was great. Robert De Niro is nominated, and then there's this one woman, Emmanuelle Riva, who I think is like 110 years old. I mean, I could be wrong, but she is nominated for Best Actress, so that's pretty exciting. Are you excited, Joe, about the Oscars?
I can't say I'm a huge movie. Of course I like movies.
Have you been to any of these ones? Beasts of the Southern Wild, any of them? Zero Dark Thirty, Silver Linings Playbook? You seem to me like a Silver Linings Playbook kind of guy. Am I wrong?
I think you might be wrong on that one. My mother did get me Beasts of the Southern Wild on DVD over the holidays, and I have yet to watch it.
I knew it would end that way.
Yeah.
So, in other news, it is the 10th anniversary of Certified Humane, which is a very important certification group. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And we have two guests on. Our main guest is Matthew Rodofker, the chef of... is that the right word?
Yeah, chef de cuisine.
Chef de cuisine of one of the most interesting restaurants in the country, Momofuku Sambar. So he's going to be on in a few minutes. But just about the Certified Humane 10th anniversary thing, it's really important to have third-party certification groups certify that things are being that animals are being raised humanely. Of course, you know, while we're talking about foie gras and California and PETA and all these people, the vegetarian movement are trying to get us to stop eating meat, and they're trying to shut down all the horse slaughterhouses. All this crazy stuff is happening. Meanwhile, animals like chickens and pigs are suffering tremendously on factory farms. It almost seems like we're fighting the wrong battles. We have to take down these big, big, big guys, or at least get them to change their ways a little bit. And I hope that they, you know, if Obama gets his way and they increase the minimum wage, I kind of think it would be good if some of these companies were not forced or maybe forced to add more animal welfare, animal humane standards into their growing practices. And if their meat becomes more expensive, that's probably a good thing. Everyone's talking about how this country needs to eat less meat anyway, so making it a little bit more expensive, making a nod towards the animals that are dying for our pleasure, sounds like a pretty good idea. Remember, pigs, they're very intelligent animals. They're just like dogs. So imagine putting a dog in a bathroom for its whole life, where it can't even move. It is really, truly 100% a crime. And then all these big companies are also avidly lobbying, against paying their workers, anything more than the minimum wage. And they also fight against cameras in slaughterhouses. I mean, the goal for cameras is not to arrest these guys, but just to make sure that the law isn't being broken, that these animals aren't falling in their own shit and then being picked back up. I mean, cameras are a good thing. That shouldn't get fought. against. But, you know, people fight about that stuff all the time. And, you know, it's just kind of unfortunate. All right. Well, Joe, how was that intro? Anything?
No, you do lots of good points.
Joe, sorry to wake you. I'm going to get better on those intros. Don't worry. But now to the main show. I'm very honored to have Matthew Rodofker in studio. Mama Fuku Sandbar is one of the most interesting restaurants in the country. For those who haven't been here, you'll hear a little bit about why. I think in large part it's because of how different the menu is. It almost breaks with the traditional restaurant menu of, you know, appetizer, main course, dessert. This is, you know, kind of breaking rules, and the things they have within their various courses are interesting in and of themselves. So welcome, Matthew. Thanks for coming in.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've had a very interesting career. You were brought up in Philadelphia, is that right?
Yeah, born and raised Center City, actually from Philadelphia, not some suburb.
So you're a Phillies fan and a Sixers fan?
And anything Philadelphia is all I root for.
They are some tough fans there. They are really loyal. I mean, to their teams.
I mean, we have pride. We're a prideful city. Yeah. Good or bad, we'll have pride.
So who's your favorite Philadelphia player of all time, any sport, two or three players?
Brian Dawkins is probably one of my favorites just because the passion he brought to the game. I think it's, you know, the same thing you need to bring into a kitchen, his level of intensity, his leadership.
Brian Dawkins, the center for the...
Now, Brian Dawkins is safety for the Eagles. He's retired now.
I see.
Yeah. He's definitely number one favorite player. Not even a competition.
Is he in the Hall of Fame? I wonder.
No. I don't know if he'll get into the Hall of Fame.
He's just Philadelphia style.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So now you had a very interesting career. So I figured we would tell, rather than me just reading your very interesting bio, I would just name the restaurants and their chefs if I have their names here. And you just tell me kind of like what is most memorable, the headline of that place. So you worked at Striped Bass.
Yeah, Striped Bass was the second restaurant I ever worked for. pretty much was out when I was in high school in Philadelphia looking to get some experience, and that was after I worked for Mark at Vetri. And
so let's start with Vetri then. Okay. Mark Vetri, fascinating guy. Mario Batali says it's like the best Italian food in America. I mean, he's very well respected. So what did you learn working with Mark?
Well, I mean, the first thing I've got to say about Mark is I was some 16-year-old kid knocking on the back of his door asking if I could come there to work for free after school. And, you know, the most important thing I learned there is, well, two things I have to say is, one, taking care of the guest. You know, making every experience individual towards the guests, and then the importance of being a teacher and how important it is to nurture someone and do something outside of yourself as either a chef or as a teacher to help grow an individual as well as grow the cooking community.
So he had a tight-knit kitchen there.
Yeah, it was. It's bigger there now, but when I was there, it was three people plus Mark, and you know, you're working 6 days a week together, you're a family.
That was a very small, very high-end restaurant. Since then, he's opened an Osteria, right?
Yeah, Osteria, and he's also opened Alla Spina and Ami, and I think more to come.
Wow. See, I didn't know all that. That's very interesting. Very, very good. So then you went on to Striped Bass, and tell me about working with the chef there and what you learned there.
I worked for Christopher Lee there, much bigger restaurant, a lot of people, very intense. But you get the same things from Chris. He's about being a teacher, getting people to learn, making people better. And, you know, I got, for me as a cook, I got to my first taste of a very intense, high-energy place. But then also from a personal level, seeing the care of a lot of people there and what it meant to take time out of day for just some kid who's looking to learn and actually, you know, give that to him, which is, to me, is something very special.
Hmm. And then you went to New York, came to New York here, and you worked with a lot of very interesting chefs. You worked at Oceana with Cornelius Gallagher.
Yep.
So that's all fish all the time, huh?
All fish all the time. A little bit of meat here and there. But
bacon, right? They buy 10 bacon slabs a week from us. So they go through bacon, I guess, on their monkfish.
Yeah, they bought some bacon. There was a bacon-wrapped monkfish at times.
So what did you learn working at Oceana?
I mean, that was one of my first experiences of really being a full-time line cook. And, you know, Neil, I've always said, is probably the best cook I've ever worked for outside of being a chef. Just him as a cook, I think no one can touch him. But there I really learned what it meant to be a line cook, to put your head down, to push, to work, and, you know, to get rid of the whole fear level of the situation and believe in yourself. And I think that's probably the biggest thing I took away from there.
Is there more waste at fish places, because once a fish gets too old, you can't really extend the life of a fish like by making a meatloaf, or, you know, like you do with meats, well, right?
I mean, there's two things. One, as a manager, you have to be conscious in how you order and how much product you buy, and that can heavily cut down your waste. Two, if you're good at butchering fish, you can minimize your waste, but it's a perishable product. You need to know how much to order, know how much you're selling. But, you know, there are times that waste can become a factor. The goal is you hope that you don't, those products that you might not be able to serve to the guests don't end up in the trash can, but you somehow utilize the product in a possible way, whether it's towards your staff or towards something. You just, you don't want to have a piece of fish, especially something that's, it's a life form, as well as something that's expensive, just end up in the garbage can.
Yeah, nothing can ever die in vain.
No.
And then you worked at, for 2 years at Crew under Shia Galante. So Crew is a intense restaurant. Where was that in the city? On the bottom Fifth Avenue?
It was on 5th Avenue and 9th Street.
Yeah.
No longer there anymore. But I would say, like, I feel like I worked there during the heyday when it was a new restaurant. You know, Shia just came out from Boulay. He's looking to prove himself. He's hungry. And it was an intense place. A lot of young guys, a lot of cooks really pushing hard, really looking to be better and to everyone looking to make a name for themselves and put Crew as one of the best restaurants in the city.
So it gets competitive in a kitchen like that, and people are like, try this dish. I want this dish to be on the menu. I mean, how does intensity manifest itself in a kitchen?
I think every kitchen is different. I think a lot of it starts from the top. I think everything in any sort of business, you know, the demeanor in which, you know, the facility is going to be starts at the top. So a lot of that in that situation came from Shay and him putting the pressure on, making, you know, there was no cutting corners. The results needed to be excellent every time, and how we got to those results needed to be proper every time. Mm. And, you know, he has to hold that standard. Same with any chef in any situation has to hold the standard.
And were they making more difficult, brash, brazen, complicated dishes to try to make it more intense of an experience?
It was definitely, there were some intricate dishes. I always like to tell some people, I was working the entremet station there where you pick up all the vegetable garnishes. There might be one plate where we would do everything to order. Pretty much everything was cooked or heated or in some way done to order, where for one singular dish, you might have five small sautoirs, you know, three purees on one plate, things that just, it can make your life a little challenging.
Well, now I understand what you mean by intensity, because I didn't know if it just meant more people were yelling or, but now when you have very complicated dishes, I mean, and plus cooking everything a la minute is very difficult. Now, sambar, it's very different. A lot of that prep happens earlier and is just...
There's a lot of prep that happens earlier, but when I sort of came into sambar, as well as with Ryan Miller, who I used to work with there, we wanted to make it much more of a technically proficient kitchen where more is done a la minute. So now every single... Or just alone, just was touch on the proteins. Every single protein is cooked for order. No heat touches a protein unless it's, you know, for a technique that's important to the cooking method. Mm-hmm. It, like, if it's something that goes on the grill, it doesn't go onto the grill until the guest orders it and it's appropriate for it to hit the grill within the timing of their meal.
Mm, very interesting. So then you worked at the intense Crew and then you really loosened it up at Danielle, huh?
Yeah.
That got really easy, I bet. No, just kidding. But you worked on a team there that got 4 stars on the Times and 3 Michelin stars. So what was your position at Danielle?
I pretty much at one point was Tournant and then worked through a lot of the different...
Tournant is like a rover, right?
Yeah. You're moving around, you're working different stations, you're involved with a lot of different things, and then as well as being a station chef there for the different station in the kitchen. I mean, that place, you know, a lot of people have misconceptions, a lot of restaurants, and I feel like Danielle is one of those places. You need to work there, and you need to work with the chefs there to really understand how well they do things and how, you know, talented a staff, such as Jean-Francois, the executive chef, Eddie LaRue, the chef de cuisine, and to see how things work, because it is such a massive restaurant, outside of just the restaurant itself, but banquets, catering, and to be able to manage something like that at such a high level is such an impressive thing.
So what is that? Is it the complication of the techniques behind the dishes, the grammar behind each dish, while keeping consistency? Is that the
You're doing extremely complicated dishes. I mean, especially at Danielle. There's things that have 20 different components to it. You're doing it with 300 covers a night with a staff of 15, you know, plus people in a service, and it's pressure. You're in a 3 Michelin star restaurant, 4 New York Times stars. It there is no leeway. There is no room for error.
Now, was there a difference in the quality of raw ingredients at each of these restaurants that we talked about? Striped Bass, Vetri, Crew, Danielle, or it's what they do with it? Or do some people just get better radishes or better lamb because they're charging more for it? Or has that become more equalized now across?
I think with all of those restaurants and all those chefs, they put a premium on the quality of the product, and that's definitely something I learned from all of them. I wouldn't say that, you know, one might get a better products across the board. Sometimes certain things might have more of an importance to the other, but it was more of the preparations and how things were handled are different based on the chefs, based on the cuisines.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So then go from Danielle to Sambar. There was nothing in between?
I was at Blue Hill for a little bit.
Oh, Blue Hill, right. And how was that? What did you learn there?
I mean, it's an amazing... And Blue Hill Stone Barns. I mean, if you've never been up there, it's a beautiful facility. It's almost, I always say, one of the perfect cook situations to have the farm right in front of you. You know, the physical space of the kitchen is beautiful, and it's you get to increase that appreciation from where the product comes from.
All right, and then let's go to Sambar. And now David Chang, who I guess owns Sambar and Momofuku Noodle Bar and Mapesh and Co., right?
Mm-hmm. And Siobo in Australia, and now you have multiple restaurants in Toronto as well.
Oh, my God. That's so stressful to have that much stuff going on. But he also came from Danielle, right?
No, he worked briefly at Cafe Balud.
Cafe Balud. And last question.
Yes.
We're doing this rapid fire, and then we're going to take a break and come back and talk. You also worked in England at Fat Duck.
Yeah, I did a stage there. I wouldn't say worked because I did a stage. I came over. I met Ashley, who at the time was the chef there when he was in New York. Danielle was closed for renovation, so I spent that time at the Fat Duck, working with them, seeing what they do, just gaining new experience.
What do they do in England? Same as we do here?
Oh, no. I mean, the Fat Duck is a restaurant unlike probably any other in the world, and they are very systematic in the way they do things, very technical. They test and run through recipes and dishes and ideas to a level that I definitely have not seen. And it's very systematic in how they work. And it's an impressive thing, the level of consistency that they try and work within.
But what are they trying to test? Ferran Adrià molecular stuff or just combinations of things?
They do a lot of that, and they're very much about the technical proficiency. A lot of what Heston focus on is sensory perception and how a guest perceives something and maybe have something visually look one way but taste a different way, and trying to kind of have fun with the guests and make the dining experience more of a fun, entertaining experience through the food itself.
That's very interesting. I told you while we were prepping for the show that I did my thing on my master's thesis on the politics of medieval food sculptures and cuisine, and for big events they always tried to do that.
Yep.
They would they did it in a visual way, like they would wheel in what looked to be a live cow, but then they would cut it open and it would be cooked. Or birds would come out of a pie, you know, the blackbird pie.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow, what a fascinating interview. You're good at describing all these places. Before we cut to break, I want to just talk about Pat Derby. She was 69. She was a champion of animal welfare. She just passed away. She's the former animal trainer for television shows like Lassie and Flipper, who became a crusader against animal exploitation and entertainment, and founded one of the largest privately owned wildlife sanctuaries in the United States. She died last Friday at her home in the San Andreas, California. She was 69. She was a champion of performing animals. She founded the Performing Animals Welfare Society, or PAWS, outside Sacramento, and she opened the ARC. And it became this ARC place became a retirement community for more than 100 exotic animals, mostly former circus performers and survivors from zoos. So Pat Derby, 69, champion of animal welfare. You know, I don't know how animals would thank her because they don't talk. But, you know, we certainly thank her and... think she did a great thing with her life. So rest in peace, and we'll come right back with Matthew Rodefker.
She sat in her garden, an old pair of jeans.
You're listening to Persephone by The Hollows on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
And she was taken from me.
Today's program has been brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run commercial offset print house that brings together environmentally friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Founded in 1998 by Eugene Lee and his father, Cam Lee, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and green technology. Rolling Press prints using soy and vegetable inks, uses a variety of certified and recycled papers, and they incorporate a chemical-free production process. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Cooking
issues! Who am I fooling?
This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die! It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we are back. I am Patrick Martins. This is the main course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, engineered by Joe Galarraga. And I have Matthew Radovker in studio, and I'll just go through the categories of the Somme menu. Country hams, that's a category. It has four entries. Seasonal, offcuts, which used to be called offal, O-F-F-A-L. Fish, another category is meat. Dessert and bosom, which now includes a duck as well. So just that's a lot of different categories. So very fascinating place, very interesting, really progressive when it started and remains so. It's always full. You're in and out quickly. You know, it's not one of those long drawn out meals, but the quality of the experience is a 3 or 4 star experience. So what is the greatest challenge at Somme Bar versus the other great places you've worked?
Well, I mean, I think there's two great challenges. One probably would be me personally as a manager, in a sense of at the other restaurants, I was not in charge of the entire restaurant. Here, I am. The level of responsibility, you know, just information that I need to hold in my head is vastly higher than the other restaurants.
And how do you, how would you judge your own management style? Is it hand-holding? Is it communication? Is it taking them around the block and talking with them?
Everything is about communication. And when you're trying, from my experience, when you're trying to teach someone, the way you teach and how you speak to someone has to be individual on who you're speaking to, because everyone perceives things differently. Everyone learns things differently. And if you just treat everyone the same or act in a monotone manner, then you're really not going to get through to some people. And you have to, and it's the same way we cook for the guests. Every guest is an individual. They have their personal tastes, desires. And if we think about things without taking the individual aspect into consideration, then we're going to fail.
And the other way?
Probably in the fact that as you said, the structure is so different. All the other restaurants I came from are either tasting menus or first course, second course, dessert. And at Somme Bar, you can dine in so many styles. There are people who come in and they want to have buns and rice cakes, be in and out. And there's people who want to order the entire menu and have a long, drawn-out tasting menu, and we have to be able to recognize that and facilitate the desires of every single guest within the parameters of the restaurant being a fast, loud, fun, energetic place. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge to really try and make this an individual experience to everyone.
It is like a tasting menu, but available off the menu. I mean, like on the menu. Like they can just basically...
Build your own tasting menu.
Yeah, normally the tasting menu, the chef is like, I've created it. This is the order. You can have 5 courses, 7 courses, 10 courses, but I'll tell you the order. Here, really, someone could order all the offcuts, and that's their tasting menu.
Yeah, they could be. And, you know, we're going to try and structure it in the way that we feel is right. the most appropriate way to eat it. Yeah. But it's really freedom to guests, for them to create their own experience, and for us to try and recognize that and deliver that experience to them.
So let's go through the first three categories of the menu, like the country hams, for instance. Do they change from batch to batch, or are they somewhat inconsistent? I mean, you buy all American prosciutto-style ham, so cured and smoked in the American tradition. So I printed out the menu. You have Finchville, Benton's, Broadbent, Edwards. This is, you know, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia. So tell us about this ham. It's such a progressive and unusually visionary category.
I mean, I'd say probably in the time that I've been at Sambar, we've had about 10 to 12 different hams on the menu, all of which American, from the same general areas. This is where hams curing comes from, based on the weather and the conditions. I mean, the goal with structuring it is to have a balance between different styles of ham. Some that are smoked, some are more aggressive in, say, salinity and aged flavor. Some that might be a little bit more balanced and light in smoke, and then some that might be a little bit more aggressive in smoke. And, you know, when we're buying any sort of product, a goal is to find a product that's consistent and high and a high quality. And I think the four that you just mentioned that are on the menu right now happen to be four of my favorites, as well as four of the most consistently high-quality products, because there is a human level in it. And sometimes you get a ham, it might be a little bit softer, it might not have that depth of flavor that it might, you know, another batch that might have had. So there's a little give and take. Sometimes we might get a ham in that's a little soft, so we might need to break it down, let it dry a little bit more so it slices a little better.
Interesting. Charming inconsistencies, I wrote, because it's better that than just the same every time. Yes. Like McDonald's or Coca-Cola. Now, the offal cut, that was also a progressive menu category back. I mean, remember, when did Sambar open? 2006. I mean, to see an all innards kind of offal, off cut section is pretty interesting. You have beef tendon, veal sweetbreads, crispy pig ear Sam, you know, and then you have many, many tripe I've seen on the menu in the past. So tell us, is it different working with offal cuts than it is with prime cuts, is the way you deal with it in the kitchen?
I mean, one, with the offals, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel here with anything. There's a lot of restaurants who have done offal. I mean, St. John's, everyone takes a huge amount of inspiration from them. I think with any product, whether it be a prime cut, whether it be a piece of fish, you have to treat it as the individual product, and the result that you want from cooking it is going to be individual. So, for example, with the sweetbreads, we've done them a few different ways, trying to get the texture of the sweetbread just the way we want, whether it be poaching it in corbouillon, cooking it sous vide, brining it or curing it for a certain amount of time till we get that result we want. And that goes for the same thing with the pig ear, where we're getting, it's got that cartilage in the center. We want that chew. We want that snap. We don't want the whole thing to be mush. We want that gelatin to come through, but it to still have texture. So how do we cook it to get the most out of it, or get it to be the nature that we desire in the end?
Very interesting. Yeah, offal cut. So, well, now take us through the main course, the meat and the fish. Are there cuts of meat that you never use?
There are definitely some that we don't use.
Why is that?
One can be from a quality of the product, or whether it be, for example, veal has always been a touchy issue. Commodity veal, the way that that product is raised is extremely inhumane. If anyone's ever seen it, they're basically, it looks like the veal is chained by the neck to the ground and in a pen where it has maybe a few inches to move horizontally, or, you know, from side to side. And it's not really something you really can stand by. On the converse, that we do have veal sweetbreads on the menu. So one interesting story that came about that is Dave was very against us using veal. So a few
Dave years, Arnold?
No, Dave Chang.
Oh, David Chang, of course. Sorry.
So a couple years ago, we heard about a farm called Provatello Farms that's based out of Canada but has a farm in upstate New York.
Okay.
And Tim Maslow, who used to be a chef there at the time, he and I rented a car, drove 7 hours up to this farm so we could see the conditions, take pictures, and report back if the conditions that these veal were being raised in was more humane than commodity veal, in a sense. And it was. They have space. They're in pens. They're not in – they have a place to move. They're outside. They're not just – in a little tiny coop where they don't even have daylight and are fed a non-natural product. So we come back, we're able to feel good about it. All right, now we can use veal sweetbreads on the menu.
Okay.
We know we found a product that we stand by and we can use.
What about cuts? Like, I know you have, I've seen over the years, consistent cuts like a hanger or ribeye. I mean, would you use... skirt steak, or would you use tenderloin ever?
And right now we have the flat iron for a beef cut. We have flat iron in the menu right now. One of our biggest goals is to bring value to the guest. The ribeye is a higher priced item. It's something we've always had. It's kind of a splurge thing. But if we were to put that same cut in the same portion size on the menu as the flat iron, the price would be a lot higher. Not the price point that we're trying to hit for the guest. We're trying to.
What is that? Do you have that number goal?
I don't like to see. 26, like the flat iron right now we have is $26. That's probably as high as I really want to get. Okay. As an entree, unless it's a special ingredient that we're really trying to show off for the guests. But we're trying in the end of the day to bring value to the guest and to do something interesting and fun and technical with products, but maybe a product that is not as common, and therefore we can bring that value to the guest by charging less money.
Well, it's funny because I only ever end up going to Sambar probably once every 3 months or something. So, of course, I spend a shit ton of money because I just can't control myself.
We always hope that people like to do that and go nuts.
But no one dish is too expensive. Now, you guys have a lot of duck on the menu.
Yes.
Is that, what's up with that? I love duck.
Well, duck is all sort of surrounded by lunch. It's something that Ryan Miller, who also used to work at Saba, now is at the Momofuku lab.
Okay.
Basically trying to do something interesting and fun with duck. And it's one of these products that we all really love. So we basically focused our lunch service around, one is the whole rotisserie duck, but then doing a lot of different dishes based around duck, like our duck dumplings, duck sandwich, duck liver mousse, and utilizing all of the different products. Sometimes we're using the tongues, the hearts, the kidneys, the liver, and doing a lot of fun, interesting dishes that are also, at the same time, accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. But using the whole animal.
As a born and raised New Yorker, the Peking duck with the duck sauce. And I love the way you guys have those three little jars of sauces.
Yeah, the Sam sauce.
Pickle shallot. Or no, fried shallots.
We have the fried shallots, and then we have the duck fat ginger scallion sauce.
God. I mean, I could spoon those into my mouth without anything else. Fish guys, aren't they always trying to sell you spoiled fish? I've always heard that about the fish guys. Their stuff spoils so damn quickly.
Yeah, I will say this about myself. Is I worked at a lot of fish restaurants. Fish, I feel, is probably, if you're saying about being good at something in a kitchen, whether it be a cook, I feel like fish is the hardest. It's such a perishable product. Every fish, whether it be the same kind of fish, like two-striped bass or a mackerel to a bass or a tilefish to a bass, they're all different. They all need to be handled with such care and a delicate touch that a lot of people don't have.
Is there a smaller margin of error of the internal temperature? It's easier to overcook?
Everything. Yeah, whether everything. You're touching it, the way you pick it up, everything is so important when you're dealing with fish. But I always say, my fish guys are the most prideful people that you will meet. I will say this without a doubt more than anybody. I had Louis Razzo in the other day for dinner, and he runs Razzo, which is a fish company that comes out of lower Manhattan. They operate fully out of Manhattan. And I was talking to him at the pass, and he's like, it's such an honor for us to sell to you. And for me, I'm telling him it's an honor to bring you because you take such pride in the product that you sell me. And I call them, I place an order at the end of the night, and he doesn't have that product or that fish is not of the standard that he feels I would like, I'll get a call at maybe 6, 7 a.m. Hey, chef, I really don't have this product to you. I could send you it, but it is not of your standard. I'm sorry. I'll try and get back. And there's just this level of professionalism and care to find the best product. Mm-hmm. And I'm not his biggest client, but we have a very strong working relationship for him to find me the best quality product and for me to do that product justice.
Yeah, for sure. Very, very interesting. Seasonal. You have a seasonal category. How many purveyors does Sam actually have?
A lot.
Like 80 or 60 or something?
It's going to vary during the time of the year.
Right.
And also, when we talk about a purveyor or supplier, we're talking about from everything from paper goods and cleaning equipment right. to truffles. So there's a lot of specialty guys.
Italian truffles?
Italian truffles, French truffles.
Are the Portland ones any good?
I don't really use them. If I'm going to go for it, I'm going to spend the money. I want the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going big.
Now, Bosam and Duxam are the communal family platters that you have to call and order in advance.
Yes.
Are those tough to master? Or, I mean, what do you do that's different? I mean, besides the fact that it's a whole duck or a whole pork shoulder.
Well, number one, it's got to be delicious. It's got to be good. So with the duck, it's not just some roast duck. There's a lot of technical proficiency that goes into it. And then it really takes about 3 to 4 days from us receiving that duck for it to get on your dinner for on your table, from breaking down the duck, turning the legs into the sausage.
We put some air in it.
We blanch it. We stuff a sausage made from the legs in between the breast and the skin. And then it needs to air dry for several days so that when we put it on the rotisserie, it's getting that proper skin. And it's a lot of work that goes into it. And the bosom, same thing. It comes in. It needs to cure for a couple of days. It needs to be roasted properly so that it's tender, moist, has that caramelization. So it's, you could just throw something in the oven or cook it, but that wouldn't be putting the same.
For sure. Maybe you answered this with the fish comment, but are there nuances? We had a colleague of yours, Sean Heller, who's the chef of Momofuku Noodle Bar, and he was talking about how ramen is such a simple friggin' thing, and yet that nuance, that little magic, is so hard to continue every single time. Is there something that you are still like, God, I can't get it every time?
I think with every part of the restaurant, whether you're being a cook, whether you're a chef, there's something that you strive to get. And if you ever think you've reached it, or you ever think you've mastered something, then I'm of the mentality that you failed. You're not actually as good. You're getting lazy. You're getting complacent. And you're never going to be as good as you could be unless you're constantly searching me better with everything.
God, David Chang must love you. That's what he would want to hear. Are you sick of making steam buns? I mean, I think it's one of the top 10 single dishes in America is the Momofuku bun. So I would never think it would be stopped being made, but...
Well, I always say to my staff and everyone, I'll always think of it as probably maybe the number one food eaten in New York, and maybe the number one most photographed food in New York.
Yes.
But it's the same thing that I said before. Always have to strive to be the best at it, to have the best product, the steam buns to be hot and fluffy every time. And when you're selling several hundreds of these a day, you got to search to always have every single bun be perfect. And if you ever get tired of it, get complacent, oh, it's just another bun, then you're going to lose quality and your product that you're serving to the guests is not going to be as good.
And then you're going to fire them. You're going to call them outside and be like, that bun was terrible. One more strike, you're out, kid.
It could happen. Or Dave will come and sit me down and have the same conversation. So
he's like, you're on top. It's your responsibility. How many seats do you have?
It depends how we see the dining room, but it's about 76, 78 seats.
Okay. And how many covers do you do on a very busy day?
It's funny. I get this a lot from people who come trail at the restaurant, and I know how many covers we'll do. I can easily check that. But there, as I said before, there's so many ways to dine in the restaurant, whether you're
going to be... Do you count a bun to go as a cover? Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, and do you count someone who has three orders of buns and leaves as a cover? It's different from, say, you know... Let's use Danielle's example, where everyone's either coming in and having a pre-fee menu or a tasting menu, and it's reservations. So here, there's a lot more flexibility. We could easily do, let's say, 250 covers on a, say last night.
Last question. We're about to have Sam Edwards come on. We got through that interview very quickly. I didn't think we'd have enough time. We're going to call Sam Edwards. We're going to talk a little bit about the importance of the Certified Humane 10th Anniversary. This has been a fascinating interview. You've got to come back. But you are, and this is what we should talk about next time, an expert on kitchen knives and American craftsmanship in particular. So what makes a good knife and what makes a bad knife, and why do you love knives so much?
I mean, to me, the knife is the most elemental tool of a cook. I mean, if you don't know how to take care of your tools, then what are you? And it's sad for me to say, but a lot of cooks and chefs that I come across don't either know how to maintain their tools and don't really know them very well. And, you know, what makes a great knife is also in the same thing of what makes a great dining experience. It's individual guests. Does it, for you personally, does it have that right balance? Or if we get a little bit more technical, has the metal been tempered properly, hardened properly? is the handle comfortable? Is the weight distribution proper for the user? There's so many factors that go into it, and that's the same thing when you put a make you know create a dish and serve it to the guests. It's very much the same thing.
I understand that you buy American, but you support the American craft movement buying knives. But who is considered the best country? Is it Japan or Germany?
A lot of people would like to think, in as far as higher end cutlery, would like to say Japan from a consistency sake and from how much that they are producing. They're probably the number one producer just from the quantity of knives that they're producing and the consistent level that it is. But if you want to talk about really high end, really that individual touch where you're talking to someone and they're creating something for you, I think people, some Americans such as Bill Burke in Idaho, Bob Kramer, Murray Carter.
Bill Cook. Let's tag these, Joe. Bill Cook.
Bill Burke.
Bill Burke.
Bob Kramer.
Okay.
Devin Thomas. Michael Rader. Murray Carter is another one. And then there's a lot of other...
That's great. We're going to tag those names. Yeah, we're going to have all those guys.
And there's
on.
Another lot of other guys who are doing this more as a hobby. It's like one guy in Westchester who's a really good friend of mine who I did a lot of testing of his knives for, Marco Sorkin. He's about 45 minutes north of here. It's not his first job, but it's something that he's really passionate about. And he is producing some of the best knives in this country and at one of the most affordable prices.
Very, very, very interesting. God. All right. You've got to come back. Joe, can you get Sam on the line? Because we are 5 minutes late because you were answering all those questions really well.
I have Sam on the line, actually.
Oh, Sammy, what's up, Sam?
Hey, Patrick.
You
I
want to
find out about
have...
the knives, too.
Do you use knives in your thing, or do you, in your craft, or do you just use huge machines?
Absolutely. I'm in the meat business, man. I got to have knives.
Oh, bro.
And lots of them, and high-quality knives.
Well, you have high-quality equipment. Tell me about the most interesting, unusual piece of equipment. You have massive machines in your plant. I was just there a couple weeks ago. What is one of the more interesting and complicated, quote-unquote, tools that you have? Like toys.
Oh, my gosh. If you go by price, probably a bacon slicer. If you go by... most recent, I had a German-made sausage stuffer shipped in, just arrived last week. The Germans make a lot of great equipment. They're kind of known for it in the meat industry. Actually, both machines were German. So, the slicer and the sausage stuffer. So
yeah,
they're
for
very,
knives,
precise
what's that called?
But that's not the art side of it. That's just getting the product sliced. Sounds pretty mundane in comparison to making duck the way it should be.
No, come on. Give yourself some credit. You guys have been in business for 90 years now. So, Sam, we've been kind of talking about a theme a little bit. Pat Derby passed away. She was very, very, very into protecting animals who had been in circuses and who had performed in Hollywood movies. And then when they got too old, they basically started to get mistreated because there was no policy in place to protect these animals. We opened the show by talking a little bit about, the importance of animal welfare and Temple Grandin's work to put cameras in slaughterhouses. So you are actually one of the biggest supporters of the Certified Humane Seal. So why is that important to you? I understand morally, but when it comes to the quality of a ham, why is that important to you?
Well, kind of going back to what you were talking about in the duck, I mean, I believe there's layers of quality that you put into a product, and each layer adds to the total quality of the product eventually. So if you're starting off with the right breed, fed the right things, raised humanely, all of those levels impact the flavor of the product when it's brought to me. If you're starting off with great product to begin with, and we do everything we're supposed to do in the curing and the aging process, the goal is to make the best flavored product.
So describe
and
it. What's
the side benefit is the moral issue.
But what's the difference? I mean, you say flavor. Can you break that down, the nuance?
You know, I go by based on the commodity pork we get and the humanely raised pork we get. And again, if I could switch everything over to humane, I would, but there's just not enough farmers raising enough pork yet to do that. I'm not sure there ever will be. Well, certainly there will never be to feed the whole world, but anyway, we're moving in the right direction. The difference is, I think, hogs in particular react to stress. Stress impacts the flavor of the pork. And I didn't know that. I didn't realize that until we started cutting the legs fresh and taste testing them just by cooking them in an oven, cooking them in a frying pan fresh from a commodity to the certified humane. And it was a significant difference. Within the breed, for instance, to do a certified humane or humanely raised Berkshire in a non-humanely raised Berkshire, the nuances get even more defined. Or not defined, I should say vague. It's harder to pick up the differences, but there is a difference. Color, aroma, taste, and again, it's multiple layers. You keep adding these layers to the product itself. All of them in combination make a huge difference.
And I think muscle structure.
I think the humane part is part of that better taste.
And the muscle structure, right? Just the fact that it doesn't disintegrate after 400 days of cure, right?
Right. That has an impact. When an animal's under stress, it's releasing certain enzymes. It's adrenaline. I'm not even sure of all the science behind it, but it impacts it actually can create something what they call pale pork. If a hog is under stress at the time of slaughter, it's releasing these enzymes. It's almost, in extreme cases, the meat in the center of the ham almost turns to the consistency of peanut butter when it's cured out. I mean, you can literally take a knife and scrape it out, and it's just like, you know, it's useless. The meat's useless at that point. But in between that and the best you can make, the stress may not turn it to peanut butter, but it impacts the flavor negatively.
I imagine. Well, Sam, I want to ask you, over the 90 years, people always have this idea that things were great. Everything was delicious. Then corporations came along, you know, industrialized the process of raising animals. And now, you know, thanks to you and other people like you, you know, we're starting to turn the chapter back and get quality again. But is that right? I mean, were we ever really producing absolutely stellar pigs back in the 20s and 30s? Or were they actually of lower quality just because people might not have thought about the rareness of the breed or how they were being raised? Can you talk a little bit about the trajectory over the 90 years?
Let's say back at the 1900s. I mean, let's face it, that's one of the problems that pork had as an animal that was used as a garbage disposal. And when you know, garbage in, garbage out, if you're feeding the animal poorly, the product is going to be not that great at the end of the day. It's edible, and it has some nutritional value, but you also had dangers of sickness from feeding hogs garbage. So what they figured out over the course of time, the breed matters, what they eat matters, and how they're treated matters. And that's why today, I think putting those things together makes better pork flavor-wise and morally than it did at any time in the history of pork. Now, can we feed everybody that way? I don't think so. I think there's still going to be a need for what I classify as commodity pork. The genius of the whole process, though, is commodity pork has improved the conditions of the animals that they're raising due to farmers that you and I work with who are doing the gold standard for raising pork. So they're trying to make it that way. They're trying to make as many pigs as they can that way, but they'll never meet the level of a farmer that's going to do, say, you know, a couple hundred pigs at a time versus, you know, some of these farms that are raising tens of thousands of pigs on a very, very small farm on concrete. You can't get the benefits of those farms that you and I go visit out in Iowa that are raising animals on grass.
Well, very, very interesting. Sam S. Edwards, it's S. Wallace Edwards and Sons, great hams, great cured meats, 90 years of tradition in Virginia. Sam, do you want to sing a little happy birthday to Certified Humane, or at least in alternatively say something about why that actual organization, which turned 10 years old this week, is important to you?
Well, I'm not sure singing's the right way to do it for me. I'm tone deaf. if it hadn't been for folks like that, just taking it from an idea and trying to put a somewhat complex but trackable system in place to hold farmers and processors like myself accountable, certainly is going to give it this whole concept credibility. It's not just somebody putting it on their label saying they do it. They really kind of force everybody to follow the rules, which I think is important, so that you're not having people put schlock out there in the marketplace.
Well, very interesting. Well, Sam is a sponsor of the radio, a huge supporter of Heritage Foods, and is going to be a guest frequently on my show and on other shows. And we're going to do a big recording extravaganza during the Fancy Food Show with the Department of Agriculture head for the state of Virginia, hopefully the governor, Sam and his friends. So you'll be hearing more from Sam. Sam, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes this Sunday. Thanks to Matthew Radovker for being on from Mama Fuko Sambar. If you have not been, you are crazy. You have to go to that place and experience it. And thanks to Joe. And stay tuned for Straight No Chaser, hosted by Katie Kiefer. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.